yesteryear.
The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, my name is Jim Butts from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from Remnus Magazine. And as we just finished the Christmas season off into the start of a 2019, can you believe it already? But some folks wanted to share with you in Remnus Magazine how their Christmas went in years past. So let's take a look at some of the stories that readers have sent in. This is by Frank Nodissi of Urbana, Illinois, titled, Many Hands Make Short Work of a Treasured Ravioli Recipe. He writes, My mom and dad started the tradition of making raviolis over 50 years ago with my brother, sister, and me helping out. We always made them on Christmas Day. After getting up early and opening our presents, we'd march into the kitchen and start the preparations for a special meal. Sometimes, as soon as we finished cleaning up, the doorbell would ring, announcing our company. For a few years, we made raviolis 1 week for Dad's family and the next week for Mom's family, but that didn't last very long. It was just too much work. We just invited both sides of the family for one big meal. The family recipe came from my maternal grandmother, Mary Sucaro, who learned it from her mother. The recipe had been handed down from mother to daughter for many generations in Sicily and carried over to Chicago, Illinois, when Grandma Sucaro's family arrived in the late 19th century. Grandma never measured anything. It was all done by intuition. The recipe wasn't even written down until the early 1960s, when Grandma was making raviolis one last time to celebrate the birth of a granddaughter. And there was a danger we would lose that knowledge. My mother and several of my aunts measured and recorded the amounts whenever Grandma called for a pinch of this and a handful of that. When we tried the recipe the following year, we agreed the raviolis were as good as Grandma's had been. Before we started making pasta, Mom made a red sauce of canned tomatoes, garlic, basil, and oregano. She added Italian sausage, pork neck bones, and homemade meatballs. Our sauce, we never called it gravy, as the characters on The Sopranos referred to tomato sauce, simmered for hours. We bask in the aroma while we labored over the raviolis. We sat around the kitchen table in an assembly line, flattening and turning the dough balls with the rolling pin. We'd fill the flattened dough with cheese, seal the dumplings with a shot glass, and crimp the edges with a fork. Anyone who needed a break would take the finished raviolis from the kitchen table to the drying sheet in the bedroom, keeping a running tally of our production. We never rolled out the dough with a pasta machine when I was a kid. We did it by hand to get the consistency just right. Everybody took turns with the rolling pin because it was a hard job. You could get fired or demoted if your rolling method wasn't up to Mom's standards. I should know. I've been demoted several times. The yearly task of ravioli making became a time to bond as we told stories about the relatives and teased other about past cooking mistakes. Nothing interfered with the process. 2 weeks after my dad died, we still gathered in the kitchen, and making the raviolis helped us get through the grief as a family. Over the years, spouses and grandchildren have joined the crew. We've also gotten high-tech. Now we grate the cheese with a hand crank grater. No more skin knuckles. And start the flattening of the dough balls with a pasta machine, though we still finish rolling them by hand. Today we make the raviolis a week in advance and freeze them instead of getting up early on Christmas Day. But Mom still makes sure we follow Grandma Siricchio's original recipe to the letter. Our raviolis are as tasty as they were when we began the tradition 50 years ago. And how many of you know of your mothers or grandparents who could make up stuff with a pinch of that? Oh, a handful of that, and watching my grandmother do favorite biscuits and stuff with no recipe, and it always turned out great. How about this one from Joyce Elaine Boring of Johnstown, Pennsylvania? Title is A Table for 66, Please. Grandma's work was a feast for the eyes and the stomach. She writes, Christmas Day 1954 will forever stand in my memory. Several inches of snow blanketed the ground and the huge pine trees that surrounded our house. I woke to a beautiful winter scene, feeling lucky to be there to see it. We spent Christmas Day with our extended family on my grandparents' farm, which was almost 300 acres. Driving through the dense forest to reach their property was an adventure in itself. Grandpa, an engineer on the Pennsylvania Railroad, spent long hours preparing his yearly Christmas feast. That year he would feed 66 of us. The festively decorated tables ran from the large country kitchen into the living room. My grandpa had prepared roasted turkeys and ducklings, mounds of fluffy mashed potatoes and candied sweet potatoes, bread stuffing, and several other side dishes. The sweets of the day were his homemade German donuts. After dinner, we sang carols and read from the Bible. Then ringing sleigh bells and a knock on the living room window announced Santa Claus, who came in burdened with gifts for everyone. How I love to remember that day. You know, if you're thinking about memories that you've made in this past Christmas, why not take a moment and write those down for later generations to remember those kind of things? It's awfully nice to pick up some of those traditions in a family and read stories that happened long ago. And what about your music during Christmas? Was it like this story by Marilyn Falwell of Lombard, Illinois? Our family has always been crazy for Christmas. Back in the 60s, when our children were small, we used to decorate three trees and every room in the house. We had music playing in the background all season long. We had LPs stacked up ready to drop into our old six-foot walnut stereo console for continuous holiday tunes while we decorated the house and wrapped gifts. Our children still remember these beautiful Christmas songs. Here are some of our family favorites. Dean Martin's Silver Bells, A Marshmallow World, and Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer. Andy Williams sings My Favorite Things, Do You Hear What I Hear, The Bells of St. Mary's, and Little Altar Boy. And always Bing Crosby, White Christmas, The Little Drummer Boy, Frosty the Snowman, and Jingle Bells. And of course, not to be forgotten, Elvis Presley, I'll Be Home for Christmas, Blue Christmas, Oh Little Town of Bethlehem, I'll Be Home on Christmas Day, and Here Comes Santa Claus. We also loved Lou Monte's novelty songs, Dominic the Donkey and Peppino the Italian Mouse. We still listen to those old favorites on CDs now instead of records, but they always evoke memories of the bygone Christmases when we were all together. It's such fun to reminisce. Now from Pat McPherson of Mount Gilead, North Carolina. If you know Pat, tell her to tune in to TRRS, and she can get this program later as a podcast. She writes, presents came with a purpose, a roadside run-in followed by barnyard swap with the makings of an unforgettable Christmas. Christmas Eve, 1952, held quite the adventure for our family, followed by a different kind of surprise the next morning. My dad, Luther McPherson, was a pastor of a small rural church in Surry County, North Carolina, about a two-hour drive from where we lived. Houses were scattered, so no one really had close neighbors. As it was the custom on Christmas Eve in many southern churches, the church members gave my dad and our family what was called a pounding, gifts of non-perishable food items to stock our pantry. On our way home that night, the car died. Dad went for help, leaving my mother, Martha, with me and my brother in the wilderness. A short time later, lights appeared. Men armed with rifles surrounded us and shined flashlights in every window. They asked questions about all the presents and the food in the car. My mother was terrified. My brother and I welcomed the excitement. The posse, it seemed, was searching for someone who had broken into nearby houses and stolen food and gifts. One man, a member of our church, recognized my mother. He explained to the group why our car was loaded with gifts. My dad soon returned with help, got the engine fixed, and we drove home, where another surprise awaited. Christmas morning, my brother and I awoke early to find a saddle under our tree. We were confused, but Dad told us to go look in the barn. Sure enough, there we found a pony and a cart. By this time, it was getting light and time to feed the chickens, milk the goat, and slop the three pigs. That's when we realized two pigs were missing. It seems Santa had swapped the pigs for a pony. We never figured out how it came to pass, but it was the best Christmas ever. That's quite a story. How about this from Franklin L. Child of Holiday, Utah? On Christmas Day in 1945, Santa delivered a big red metal box containing the largest erector set on the market. It had two electric motors and the metal parts to build an almost infinite assortment of devices, including a robot. That idea fascinated me, so I immediately got to work. What resulted was a wonderful 2-foot-tall metal man with light bulb eyes and motorized legs capable of walking. I brought my robot to school and showed him to the class. Within a few days, I received a telephone call from KSL Radio, inviting me for a live interview on one of their programs. I gladly accepted, arriving on Saturday morning at the appointed hour for the interview. They even took a picture of us. What a great story. How about in the section called Our Lives Under Our Heroes? A cocked helmet in wartime. Son uncovers a piece of Dad's history in an unlikely flea market find. This is by Roger Hill of Wichita, Kansas. He writes, "My dad, George Robert Hill, Jr., fibbed about his age and joined the Army when he was 17 in 1942. I think it was pretty amazing that many young guys did that entering World War II. During World War II, he saw action all over Europe, including the Ardennes Offensive, commonly called the Battle of the Bulge. In April 1945, his division liberated the Buchenwald concentration camp, an event Dad was especially proud to have participated in. He was honorably discharged in January of 1946. Dad was in the tank corps and had been part of the crew of an open-top tank fitted with a 105-millimeter howitzer gun. My father rarely discussed the battles he fought in, the medals he won, or the buddies he lost on the battlefield. But occasionally he would talk about the big fighting machine he served on. So I had some idea what it looked like. Fast forward to January of 2013. My wife Terry and I were at the monthly Kansas Coliseum flea market north of Wichita. Normally Dad would have joined us, but he was always on the lookout for John Wayne or movie cowboy memorabilia. But he was sick that day. At the booth, I came across an envelope labeled Official Photographs, U.S. Army Tanks, and one showed what appeared to be a type of open-top tank Dad had served on in the war. Printed on the photo was 105-millimeter gun mounted on a medium tank chassis. After a quick call to my father, who confirmed that was the gun his tank used, I bought the old set and sent Dad a copy of the open top tank picture, say that 10 times. A few days later, he called. "You must not have looked very closely at that photo," he told me, "because I'm in it." I took a good look this time, and sure enough, There was my father, standing in the middle of a group of men, his helmet cocked a little to one side. Dad always wore his helmet that way, which is how he was sure it was him. I'm still amazed that I just happened to stumble upon something so small, yet so significant to our family history, amid the thousands of items at that sale. Dad passed away in 2015. The photo of him serving his country will remain a cherished Hill's artifact for years to come. You can also submit a story of any of the things of history and people you want to, and make your heroes our heroes. Go to reminisce.com/submit a story, and you can do that, and Monday, hopefully, have it published in Reminisce magazine. I suppose asking someone for a date has changed a lot over the years, but here's a story from our lives. True love, prim and proper forever. The following protocol was the only way to date. This was by Ariel Morales, El Cajon, California. When I left school in California to return to Mexico in 1956, I was 21 and went to work in my father's fishing cannery. I swore to all my relatives and friends at that time that I would remain a bachelor until I was 30. Then one day I spotted Mary, age 19, at a traditional Mexican afternoon dance in Ensenada. She was beautiful, poised, and slim, with long brown ponytail. To say I was smitten would be an understatement. But she was with a male partner, so I could not interfere. Proper social protocol in Mexico in 1950s demanded formality. I soon learned that Mary was working as a teller in a bank, Banco Mexicano de Occidente. Oddly enough, though, I thought I had seen her at a different bank. The mystery was solved when I found out Mary had a twin sister, Teresa, who worked at the other bank. During this time, another dilemma confronted me. I couldn't just walk up to Mary and ask for a date, as that was considered too forward. So I persuaded a mutual acquaintance to introduce us. From that moment on, I courted Mary, but always with a chaperone, her twin, Teresa, present. 3 weeks after we met, I swallowed my sworn statement about bachelorhood and proposed. Because Mary's father had died in a plane crash, my parents formally asked her mother for her hand. We were married in Ensenada in 1958. 5 years later, in 1963, we moved to San Diego. We had two children and eventually five grandchildren. Mary worked as a supervisor at a savings and loan association, and I worked for the California state government until 1998 when I retired. One summer day the following year, Mary was diagnosed with an incurable immune disorder. The doctor gave her almost 2 years, and I became her caregiver. She was a trooper and fought her illness with everything she had until she died 3 years later on August 18, 2002. Is it possible that love continues to grow more with time? It did for Mary and me. Does love end when one soulmate dies? After 44 years together, we were inseparable. A plaque I gave Mary many years ago sums up our life together. We are one love forever. Turning to another story from the Our Lives section, Just a Spoonful of Sugar. Siblings shared a sweet secret about the school basement. This is by Rosemary Ashby, Ken's father, of Redondo Beach, California. Rex Ashby, my dad, was a hardworking man in blue overalls who raised nine children, seven girls and two boys, during the Depression. In his prime, he was an inventor and jack of all trades. At one time, he was a custodian at the high school in Hoover, Washington, on the Columbia River, about 12 miles east of Kennewick. But what I remember most about my father is his passion and skill for candy making. Divinity, Pinoche, and Cocoa Sour Cream Fudge were his favorites, and Dad's reputation as a candy maker lasted his whole life. While stoking the coal furnace in the basement of the red brick schoolhouse where he worked, he would wait for the fire to die down, pull out a bag of ingredients he'd brought from home, and just before the furnace needed stoking again, start cooking his confections. He held a mixture over the hot coals, using a pot with a long piece of wood attached to the handle. When we sniff the aroma of fudge or popcorn coming through the ventilation system, my siblings and I knew Dad was busy mixing up a treat. We would sneak down to the basement between classes, sometimes bringing guests with us. We moved when Dad worked in the Portland, Oregon shipyards for a time, eventually returning to Kennewick. Here, Dad graduated to bigger and better candy-making techniques. He bought an enormous marble slab and a candy thermometer so he could gauge the temperature of the boiling mass of candy. Once it reached the critical stage, he would throw his concoction onto the cooled slab and swirl it until it cooled and set up. It was just the right consistency. I have to admit there were times when I tired of homemade fudge and yearned for the store-bought candy bars we got at Christmas. But over the years, my feelings changed. As my sisters and brothers and I had children of our own, we often visited Grandpa Rex and Grandma Martha, and a tradition was born. The first order of business, find the fudge. That memory still rests warm on my heart and the hearts of my children. By Rosemary Ashby, Ken's father, Redondo Beach, California. How about this on the family tree? One trip, two lifetime events, a 500-year legacy became the preamble to their ancestral visit. This is by Herbert L. Dellinger, Jr. of Memphis, Tennessee. He writes, Both sides of my family include ancestors who were German Lutherans and settled in western North Carolina in the 1750s. Although I have written records of their lives in America, including their participation in the Revolutionary and Civil Wars, I had nothing about their earlier lives in Germany. On October 31, 2017, Lutherans celebrated the 500th anniversary of Martin Luther's 95 Theses, which began the Lutheran Reformation and which traditional history has said were nailed to the door of the Castle Church in Wittenberg, Germany. My cousin Bruce, his wife Holly, and I joined a group traveling to the city to participate in the celebration. We worshiped at an English service at Castle Church and in German at City Church. While we were there, we visited some sites with a group before driving south to where our Dellinger ancestors had lived. We started at Dillingen, a town with a name similar to ours. The town's church records had been transferred to Stuttgart, so we were unable to search them. But the people we met and the food we had were exceptional. The next day, we went to Oberracke, where the Dillingers had moved before coming to America. It was Saturday, and the village church was closed. As we were about to leave, a woman leaned out her window and asked if she could help. She spoke no English, but invited us into her home and served refreshments. Then she summoned an English-speaking neighbor who retrieved records of our ancestors dating to the 1600s. We photographed the documents and attended worship the next day. I don't know which stirred greater emotion on that trip, the celebration of the Reformation or worshiping where my forefathers had 400 years ago. Now some stories for car loving fans. A true original, it's impressive now as it was then, John Zerura of Worth, Illinois. Having saved enough money at 17 from working after school and on weekends to buy a car, my first choice was a new Corvette. But I soon realized I couldn't afford to pay cash for one. Fortunately, I quickly fell in love with the Corvette's little brother. I bought it new, black interior with red interior and all the options I wanted. Being a cool dude, I even added some bolt-on accessories to give it a mild custom look. I'm long past 17 now, but that same car is still in my garage. It's all original, including paint and interior, and despite the custom touches I installed, it can be returned to stock condition as I kept the original parts. This is the car my late wife Pam and I dated in and drove on our honeymoon. Our children John, Dawn, and Mike came home from the hospital in it, and after they were born, it left an indelible impression on our lives. When I was still in high school, about 14 months before I met Pam, my car also left an impression on someone else. Dee had a new Thunderbird that was in a shop for repairs, and she asked me if I could give her a ride home from school. I'm a car enthusiast, and I love to attend cruise nights. At one of these events on August 15, 2013, I recognized Dee and reminded her of the time half a century earlier when I'd given her a lift. She looked puzzled at first, then a smile spread across her face as she remembered. Dee was on her own, too. After the recent death of her husband, a short time after the car show, Dee and I began seeing each other. I'm delighted to say our relationship continues to this day. Once again, my little car has served me well. Now, Bob Seger and this maker's light trucks are famously linked. This is the only car designed and built by a major U.S. maker with a rear-mounted air-cooled engine. The brand was introduced in the autumn of 1959, and as an answer to cars popular in Europe, particularly the Volkswagen Beetle. Activist Ralph Nader wrote the aspects of the car's handling made it unsafe. The year this was built, the Beach Boys' car anthem was 409 and the B-side to Surfing Safari. I think the Ralph Nader article was a tip-off to what this car was. How many of you guessed that this car he's talking about was a 1962 Chevrolet Corvair, deemed unsafe anywhere, I think, was a story. Okay, let's check in some time capsule items here. From 1946, January 8th, Gladys Presley helps her son Elvis buy a guitar in Tupelo, Mississippi, when he turns 11. January 10th, 1946, the first session of the United Nations is held in London. Who knew that? And February 15th, 1946, the U.S. Army reveals ENIAC, one of the first electronic digital computers. The machine was 150 feet wide. Wow. How about that? Well, looks like we've run out of time for today's episode of Reminisce. Be sure to listen and tune in next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Jim Butts for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after our broadcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. So long until next time. If you have any questions or comments, please call 919-832-5138.